Well, I just can't turn down this offer this good. Those kind of indicators, they should have known it was late. They also would have known by the constant complaints of farmers about the percentage of their income that was going for land taxes. Well, in the mid-60s, it emerged as a public issue, at least in our state and in New Jersey and in Maryland. And by 1968 to 73, it was the hot issue. In 1968, as I told you this morning, in our state, we passed a constitutional amendment, and in 1973, we finally got through a bill, which I think is also instructive. Notice that it took 5 years for the legislators to listen to what the public told them in 1968. They have always been the great laggards in our society. In 1974, we figured, well, thank goodness, that's over. We can go on to something else, like other means of saving farmland. No way. No way. Out of the passage of the current use law have come about four other leftover issues, and the coalition that we formed to deal with it, I was just on the phone yesterday, is now busy formulating plans of how to deal with the leftover issues. No issue is probably ever solved. Instead, it just goes on and takes a different form. Now, after this important question of latent issues, let me tell you how we chart them, how we dream up what they're going to be. One of the things the sociologists have taught us is a basic rule that goes like this. Any change in the relationship between two groups is the result of an abuse on the part of one. Any change in the relationship between two groups is the result of an abuse on the part of one. Now, abuses, as we know, may be mere perception. It may be a perceived abuse. It may be a real abuse. It may be a historical abuse, something that happened years ago, such as the civil rights controversies, which often arise from an emotional base that occurred maybe 80, 60, 40 years ago. Or, of course, it may be a feared future abuse. Here's what we have done, applying that. We make, for all of our public, what we call an abuse list. Just a very simple abuse list. And we write down, what have we done in the past that ripped them off? I mean, let's be candid about this. What did we do and why did they get mad? We list those things. Then we say, what might we do now that would really make them angry? And from looking at those two lists, we come up with a pretty good chart of what the latent issues affecting us are, where the activists are apt to spring up. It's an interesting technique also, making an abuse list, because it requires people in the organization to sit down and talk about their perceptions of how the institution is relating with the public, of how it's being perceived or accepted or rejected, whatever the situation may be. Let me share with you, well, one other point I want to make, because I think this is important to our subject. I talked about the stereotypical activist. Sidney Lenz is one of the real followers of activist organizing in this country. And he says that in the 80s, we may go back now from the white-collar activist to a really reactivated stereotype activist out of sheer jealousy. He concludes that having turned activism over to people in shirts and ties, that the folks who don't wear shirts and ties when they're activists are now getting a little restive and they want to get back into the act. And he perceives their activism as taking a whole new phase. He sees the linkage of political issues to music and poetry once again. Now, if you look at the music and poetry of the last 10 years, it started out in the late 60s being full of social content. I mean, real messages were being sent in popular music. Today, I mean, you know, I don't know how you get any messages out of punk rock. I suppose there are some, but the content is not explicitly social action. Lenz feels that we are going to see a whole arising now of the arts used for social activism. That's going to be a tough one for us because, frankly, I don't know how to deal with the arts. It seems to me they are certainly beyond arguing with. How do you fight a popular novelist which takes a negative view of your issue? How do you deal with a song that everybody is singing? Well, the only way I know to do is to take those songs and turn them around and put our words to them and sing them back. And we have done that on a number of occasions. It's memorable. Very memorable. Think back to the days of the Flower Children. They were all singing some of those songs by writers and musicians that you all know. Where Have All the Flowers Gone? Remember that one? Turned a whole generation of people into a new view of life. And if Sid Lenz is right, it's going to happen. And here's the worst part. Here's the worst part. He predicts that some of the topics that are going to be popular in the new music, because remember, the things you can write a popular song about is pretty limited. You know, it's boy, girl, it's the joys of some other aspect of like parenthood or childhood or something like that, or it's, you got it, animals. That's the other thing we love to have popular songs about. And if you look at popular music in America, those are three of the areas. Just think of the popular songs about animals. I mean, you all know 100 songs about animals that create a feeling for animals the way Bambi created a feeling for animals. So I think for you folks, particularly, Lenz's prediction bears some looking at. How are we going to deal with this? If these folks turn up and decide that indeed animals or some other issue that's important to you is something to organize around, what are we going to do? Well, let me make some suggestions, and then let's talk about it. The first thing that we have tended to do in the past when an activist issue arises is to put out information that will indeed show that it isn't so. We correct the record. Well, I wonder about correcting the record. I wonder about responding. I have come to be very wary about responding. I think Bill Agee at Bendix Corporation probably gave us our best recent example in the famous original Mary Cunningham flap. It turned out to be a lie anyway, because now they're married. You all remember that. A rumor was going around the company. Bill didn't like this rumor, so by God, he was going to speak up. So he did speak up. He called all the managers together, 600 of them, and he said, I want you to know that the fact that Mary is very young and happens to be female and has only been with us 15 months, and the fact that there's a rumor that I happen to like her, all of that has nothing to do with her now being made a senior vice president. An extremely credible message. But you know what happened. The Detroit Free Press was sitting in the back. They ran a big article on A.G. and his girlfriend, and it was off and running. Now, Mary Cunningham, I'm sure, is laughing all the way to the bank. If she has any brains at all, she's now a public celebrity, and she commands high prices for giving lectures, and otherwise she would now be just a 32-year-old vice president of Bendix, and her present position is far better. I have a hunch if A.G. had kept his mouth shut, the rumor would have gone around the factory, and he would have had to listen to it a little, and probably he and Cunningham wouldn't be married. She would have quit and gone and got a better job somewhere with a more handsome CEO, and it would have been the end of the saga. But this is what we tend to do. I have a theory that most issues are self-manufactured. They are self-manufactured because we respond to somebody else's criticism. You should know about the study that was done on the Toronto Globe and Mail. The Toronto Globe and Mail is Canada's New York Times, if you don't know it, the national newspaper. The head of a local company, which was strongly attacked in the Globe and Mail, both in the news columns and the editorial columns on a specific day, convinced his management to shut up. Just don't say anything. And here's what he found. He found that despite headlines in the national newspaper, which of course was immediately picked up by TV, radio, and all the wire services all across Canada, he found in a study the following day that 30% of the people had some recollection of the flap. 30% had some recollection of the flap. By the next week, about 4% had any recollection. Oh yeah, let's see, that company, yeah, I've heard of that. And that was about the extent of their knowledge. He then charted a similar occurrence, in fact, it's a very most unfortunate occurrence now going on in the same city of Toronto. You may have read about it. A nurse was accused of killing a number of infants at Babies Hospital, kids, sick kids hospital. And the institution, instead of saying not an awful lot about it or whatever, made a response which was a little bit off the mark, and it's been on the front pages ever since. He charted that, and he found that when the issue began, the same 30% the next day knew about it. As the hospital responded and kept responding and kept responding, by the following week, about 70% of all Canadians knew about the issue. So in other words, no comment may not be an absolute no-no. I have a hunch that many of us come from journalistic backgrounds, and we still feel that someone anointed the media to a special role in society. I suggest to you that it just ain't so. Particularly today, they are businesses. They care a hell of a lot more about the buck than anything else. When Kay Graham at the Washington Post makes a 4% cut in her editorial staff in order to switch the monies to stock touting so that Washington Post stock will do better on the New York Stock Exchange, that sends a clear message to me. And if you need a clincher, 2 years ago, the New York Times fired a member of the owning family. You know, the Times is owned by a tight little family. They fired a member of the owning family who was editor of the editorial page because he offended the local advertisers in his editorial. Now, given that kind of a media situation, I think we have to get off our idealistic horses and take a look at how we really should deal when an issue arises. The journalists themselves, fortunately, have told us how they see news. I don't know if you saw the recent study by the American Society of Newspaper Editors, but it's quite revealing. They define news as something that affects people's lives. That's first. About 41% of them think that that's the highest definition of news. Well, now ask yourself, how often are the controversies you're involved in really going to affect people's lives? Or are you just playing to the media's need for entertainment? Let me prove the point. Raise your hand. All of you that were personally affected by the Falklands War, raise your hand. Well, I mean, it was on the front pages for weeks, and it was on television, and we were immersed in it. How many of you were personally affected? No matter what had happened in that war, short of escalation to become world war, would it have affected our lives in this country? Very, very doubtful. It's entertainment, and that's what we're being sold. So, that's why the highest number that they could get in their own survey to stand for a certain single principle was 41%, and that was that it affects people's lives. So ask yourself, does it affect people's lives? The second thing is what they called interest, but what they really meant was unknown or peculiar facts. That's their second guide for news. It contains unknown or peculiar facts. It's an oddity, in other words. And 32% of the members of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, which as you probably know is probably the most influential editorial association that we have, that's what they think is news. The third one is timeliness. And 17% think that's the key to news. In other words, never mind the content, when did it happen? If it just happened, it's news. It's important enough, it's the recency that counts. Fourthly is, where did it happen? Proximity. And about 5% of them think that that's news. And fifth is prominence, meaning a prominent person is involved, and about 2% of them think that's how you define news. Now, you'll notice right away, I think, what I noticed, and that is that they don't practice what they preach. Because from my watching and reading of the media, this one right here is where what makes news is, you know, if a movie star tells us, a television hero tells us his or her opinion about the nuclear arms race, that's news. They're great experts. They know all about it. And so it's worthy of front page coverage. I think you're starting to get what is undoubtedly a bias of mine, but an educated bias. In 25 years of working with the media, and by the way, before that, I owned a string of daily newspapers, so I think I have at least some understanding of it. I have come to the conclusion that many of you have, and that is that the media is not an arbiter appointed by anyone. It is an important feature in American life where government actions are concerned, because the role of the media in monitoring the government is acknowledged. Beyond that, responding always to the media in an untimely fashion can have extremely deleterious effects. Let me just prove that to you one more time. Three Mile Island has to be one of the public relations tragedies, if you will, and that's all it was. As you know, nobody was hurt. It was a public relations tragedy. By the way, when I called the guy named Howard Shortridge, Seldom Ridge, was the public relations director for the utility that ran it, and for PR Reporter, I was able to reach him a couple of days afterwards and ask him, how did all this happen? And he was still close enough to the event that I think he was canvassed. By a week later, of course, he was rationalizing all over the place, but here's what he told me. He said, you know, he says, I've worked here for 18 years, the plant's been built for 12. I've spent most of every day putting out news releases that said there's no chance of an accident, don't worry about it, it can't happen. And he says, when there was an accident, he says, for 48 hours, my staff and I literally couldn't believe it. We believed our own news. In any event, when this Three Mile Island tragedy was occurring, as you know, the aspect of it that became harmful was the media coverage of an alleged incident. Unfactual alleged incident, and the way that this was blown into an item without any ability of the nuclear operators to deal with that media situation. Now, clearly, they were in a difficult position. I'm not sure any of us would have done any better. But when they finally got the facts, they discovered that it was some valves that had malfunctioned. You would expect then that the valve manufacturer would immediately be on the hot seat, but not Babcock and Wilcox, because the press, of course, descended on them. And Babcock and Wilcox simply said, we have no comment at this time. This is a big issue being blown out of all proportion by you and the media, and until we know the facts, we aren't saying anything. They said a long version of no comment until we've conducted some research. The press was at them unmercifully. And a week later, they announced that in 6 months, they would complete their studies of what really happened, not conjecture, not seat-of-the-pants answers, but real scientific studies. And at that time, they would invite all the media in and tell it like it was. And they were as good as their word. And 6 months, they didn't say anything for 6 months. And 6 months later, they called the press in, showed them their studies, showed them that they had been very sincere in all this, and came out of that probably a stronger, better trusted company than they were going in. Meanwhile, Metropolitan Edison Company, as you probably know, is about to go broke. They're the ones that operate Three Mile Island. So the question of response becomes a critical question. But there are other ways of looking at this. Of course, response is a difficult problem. At the best of times, I'm reminded of the young lady who took the cruise after high school, who thought she'd probably never get to go again, so she kept a diary. And on the first day of her diary, she said, I've seen the ship, it's big, it's beautiful, and there are 600 people on board, and I think I'm going to have a gorgeous time. And the second day, she wrote in her diary, wow, things are even better than I thought. I've been invited to dine with the captain tomorrow night. The third day she wrote in, hallelujah, I think the captain likes me. The fourth day she wrote in, it's getting better and better, he's young, he's handsome, and I think we might be able to hit it off, except that he is kind of starting to, I think, make passes at me. The fifth day she wrote in, horrors, the captain is so enamored of me and is pressing me so hard that he threatens to sink the ship unless I give in. And on the sixth day, her response, what she wrote in was, I just saved the lives of 600 people. So we all respond differently at different times. But how do you respond to activists? That's a key question, isn't it? Let me share with you some observations of the Allstate Insurance Company, which has been activized up one side and down the other for its alleged redlining of areas. You're probably familiar with the redlining issue. That's where homeowners and city officials and others claim that insurance companies refuse to give insurance in parts of the city which become slums, and the result is property values go down, and it virtually condemns a section of a community to being bulldozed. After about 5 years of this, Nan Kilcary, who handles, who does your kind of job for Allstate, came up with an 8-point checklist. Here's what she says. How to deal with activists. One, don't be shy right at the beginning about stating your legitimate motives. In other words, if they're attacking you for making a profit if you were a company, say right off, you bet your boots. That's legitimate for us to make a profit, and we're doing it. In other words, don't back down from things that you have already said are your policies. In the case of some of your issues, like animal rights, assert in a calm, quiet way, of course. We always have to be ladies and gentlemen about it, but assert the legitimacy of what you are doing. Secondly, be willing, however, to recognize that the activists have some legitimate claims. Don't, for heaven's sake, come out and say, we're all right, they're all wrong, because Allstate tried that and found that it didn't work. Thirdly, says Nan, be sure you know what is public information on your organization and your members. In other words, know the skeletons in the closet, know your past history, because the activists will find them out every time and whitewash them all over the issue. And she found that they would get data that made Allstate look pretty bad. But if Allstate knew about it, she was at least in a position to be prepared, and oftentimes to deal with it first herself. Fourthly, be sure to give confrontation training to your managers. And she's so right. She is so right. And she says, by the way, when they do it at Allstate, they always do it far worse than even the most outspoken activist would probably do. Prepare them well. Fifth, if possible, deal with the activists before they reach the angry stage. In other words, don't sit in your office saying, well, you know, it isn't really serious yet. If you can see that there's a core of an issue there, deal with the activists. Not responding to the media now, but dealing with the activists. Deal with them before they really start taking up the issue all that publicly. Sixthly, if it comes to the point where media are involved, be sure you brief the media before the activists do. You take the initiative, she says. You get out there and you tell it. Now, that goes back to standard psychological studies. As you probably know, the studies are fairly clear on indicating that if you are going to deal with an issue, you are better served to tell both sides of the story. Tell your side and tell their side, but you be the source. Because if you go to the media and you say, here's what happened, and you tell the other guy's side as well as your own, when the other guy comes screaming in saying, look at this awful thing they're doing, the reporter says, yeah, I know. Big deal, I already heard about that. Well, Nan has found that that academic study, in fact, works. Finally, she divides activist groups into two different types. One are those who enjoy confrontation for its own sake. They leave little room for negotiation, and they really can't be dealt with, but may burn themselves out. These are folks that just really enjoy, these are the zealots, they want a confrontation. The second type, far more dangerous, are ones who enjoy a confrontation to get attention to themselves and to their issues. They are indeed using public relations techniques of awareness to attract attention to their issues. She has found that they, unlike those who are enjoying confrontation for its own sake, will listen to your responses, and they can be dealt with, and you'd better, she says, because those kind of organizations have staying power. They'll be around a while. Finally, her eighth point is to learn the activist's manual of tactics. And this is the way she describes them. The first tactic of an activist is to let you think that power is with them. In other words, to let you, the target, think that the activists are powerful. I wish I could tell you about some of the 6- and 8-person meetings that I've sat with for clients at the start of movements. Just nobody there, nobody cared. But the target didn't know how to respond. And pretty soon we had 800 and 8,000 and 80,000, and it just goes upward from there. So at the start, an activist group has to make the target think that they are powerful, but they often aren't, not at that stage. Secondly, be sure and stay inside the experience of your members. In other words, don't get dragged away on issues that are beyond the experience of Farm Bureau, of Farm Bureau people, because then your own members won't know what's happening and you'll lose them. Whereas the activists, of course, will try to go outside of your experience. So they will keep trying to drag you outside, and you've got to keep trying to stay inside. Notice that the activist group, however, will always stay inside the experience of its own members. So the counterfoil is to try and drag them outside. Thirdly, and this is the one where we're really vulnerable, activists will make the target live up to its own rules, to its own policies. She finds, in her case with the insurance company, it is usually impossible. That they will quote all the glorious corporate policies to you. Here it is, you said right here, and the president gave this speech. And as she said, most of the time, we shouldn't have said it because we really can't do it. So be sure that your policies are not open to that kind of negative interpretation by activists. Ridicule is the most potent weapon. Ridicule is the most potent weapon. Threats are far more powerful than action.
May I interrupt?
Yes, please, do.
Back to ridicule. Us use it, or
no,
just understand
this is,
that
I'm talking now about, this is the action.
You said effective.
These are their tactics, terribly effective. They will ridicule you. You're big, you're powerful. And so you're just ripe for ridicule. We always tell jokes about big institutions, and everybody laughs. We make fun out of their names, and there seems no way of escaping this. When Allegheny Airlines was Allegheny Airlines,
Agony.
They were Agony Airlines, right. So they changed the name to U.S. Air, and now everybody calls them Useless Air. And believe me, they are, if anybody ever had to fly with it. But the fact is that this is endemic to do this to established organizations. And so activists will use ridicule, and if they can make it funny ridicule, that much the better. It really grabs the public. Threats are far more powerful than actions. If any of you have ever been involved in labor disputes, you'll know that you don't ever, on either side, want to get forced to have to do what you're threatening to do. Because A, you probably can't do it, and B, it probably won't work. So it's just a fight between the threats. And if you're ever called to action, you're in trouble. And so they are going to use threats and probably not follow through in most times with any kind of action, or at least effective action. And finally, the activists, as Nan sees them, are going to attack your honesty and credibility. That is the thing to constantly get at. Now let's take a look at this and see what we can do to respond. Let's assume they are going to attack our credibility. Well, we know some things about credibility. We know what they're going to try and do. We know, first of all, that there are two sides to credibility. One of them is expertise. And in most cases, when attacked by an activist, you will have the expertise. If an activist is talking to you about the animal issue, the chances are you have the expertise, and they may not have that same expertise. The missing ingredient, however, is the other side of credibility, and that is trustworthiness. Now, finding somebody that has both expertise and trustworthiness to be a spokesperson